We are determined that Kalawao shall be a place of law. The resurrection of this dreadful lazaretto, where for 6 years condemned human beings had been thrown upon the beach to die without a single incident of assistance from the society that had rejected them, dated from that morning when the determined woman, whose spirit had not been broken by leprosy or rape or indignities such as few have known, said solemnly, "Kalawao shall be a place of law." A rude organization was evolved, consisting of people responsible for parceling out the food, a team to bring water into the village, and informal policemen who were to stop the aimless rape of unprotected women. Girls who arrived on the beach unattached were ordered to pick a man quickly and to stay with him. And when a young wife argued, "But I am married and I love my husband," older women told her sternly, "You have left the world. You are in a waiting station for hell. Pick a man. We warn you." So some women passed in turn from one dying man to another, but in an orderly fashion, and not according to the rule of rape. Children, banished without their parents, were given to kokuas who took them as their own and fed them. And one law was paramount. When an old man or an old woman was clearly about to die, he must no longer be left in the open fields. He must have some kind of shelter. Even when the settlement thus disciplined itself, the government in Honolulu gave little help. Lepers were still thrown upon the beaches to die, and there was no medicine, no lumber, no consolation. But in mid-1871, a Hawaiian who had read many books arrived in the lazaretto, and he launched a more formal government, one of whose first decisions was that the two Chinese must no longer be banished to the foot of the cliff, but must be allowed to live among the others. This decision was applauded among the lepers, since it was generally agreed that the coming of limited humanity to Kalawao dated from the night when Mun Kai decided to protect his wife from the rapists or die. A rude hospital was started, with no doctors but with leper nurses, and women who could read opened a school for children born in the lazaretto. A committee begged the government to send regular supplies of food, 5 pounds of fresh meat a week for each inmate, plus 20 pounds of vegetables or poi. And sometimes it arrived. Gardens were started, and a water supply, and the women insisted, "Kalawao shall be a place of law." There were, of course, still no organized houses in the leper settlement, and over half the afflicted people slept year after year under bushes, with no bedding and only one change of clothing. These, naturally, died sooner than even the ravages of leprosy would have dictated, and perhaps this was a blessing. But even the most horrible, crawling corpses somehow longed for homes of their own, a shack with a grass roof where they could preserve the illusion that they were still human beings. Therefore, in June 1871, Nyuk Tsin, after 5 weeks of living inside the community but on the bare ground, decided, "Wu Chow's father, we are going to build ourselves a house." Her shattered husband had already begun to lose his toes and fingers and could not be of much help. But she made believe that it was he who was doing the work, and to keep his interest focused on the future, she discussed each step of the building with him. Daily, she trudged to a ruined Hawaiian house built a century before and hauled back heavy stones, standing with them in her arms while he decided exactly where they should be placed. In time, a wall was built, and the two shivering Chinese had at least some protection from the winds that howled across Kalawao in the stormy season. Next, she sought the ridgepole and the few crossbeams that were essential for the roof. But this was a difficult task, for the government in Honolulu had consistently forgotten to ship the lepers expensive lumber, which had to be imported all the way from Oregon. For although the leaders of the state were practicing Christians, and although their consciences bled for the lepers, they instinctively thought, "Those with my paki will soon be dead. Why really should we waste money on them?" So to get her precious timbers, Nuktsin stationed her husband along the shore, where he prayed both for the arrival of driftwood and for the speed to grab it before someone else did. Once he hobbled proudly home with a long piece of timber, and the ridgepole of the roof was slung into place. Now, when the two Chinese lay in their house a-building, they could look up through the storm and see that promising ridgepole and think, soon the rains will be kept away. While her husband guarded the shore, Nuktsin taught herself to climb the lower cliffs that hemmed in the Leper Peninsula, and after a while she became as agile as a goat, leaping from one rock to another in search of small trees that could be used as crossbeams. But goats had roamed these cliffs so long that few trees survived where once forests had stood. But wherever the agile Chinese woman spotted a fugitive, she climbed for it, as if she were racing the goats for treasure. These were days of alternate exhilaration and despair. It was good to see Mun Kai taking an active interest in life, such as it was, and Nuktsin often felt a surge of personal pride when she uprooted a tree high on the cliffs. But in the afternoons, when the couple gathered piligrass and braided the panels for their future roof, exasperation would overcome them, and Mun Kai often cried, "We have the grass panels finished, but nowhere can we find the crossbeams on which to tie them." Those were the days when the missionary advisors to the king in Honolulu argued, "We must not waste money on Kalawao." One day, a whole board, long enough, if carefully split, to provide crossbeams for an entire roof, washed ashore from some distant wreck. And for a moment, Mun Kai thought that he had secured it for himself. But a big man named Palani, whose feet were still sound, rushed down and captured it. So the Chinese continued to sleep under the open roof, with the rain upon them night after night. But they were luckier than many, and they knew it, for they had side walls to protect them from the wind. They had the solid ridgepole of their roof, and they had the piligrass panels finished and waiting to be slung into position. More, they had a rude kind of spiritual peace. Mun Kai, sitting on the rocks by the sea waiting for driftwood, often looked toward the cliff where his sure-footed wife risked her life daily in search of timber, and a change came over him. He was not aware of it, but Nuktsin began to sense that her husband no longer felt inwardly ashamed of her Hakka strength. Once he had even gone so far as to admit grudgingly, "I watched you climbing on the high rocks. I would be afraid to climb there." This gave her much consolation, but the spiritual repose derived principally from another development. As long as the two Chinese had been total outcasts, even among the lepers, there had been a kind of enforced loyalty between them, for if either fought with the other, there was truly no hope left, so they were bound together by bonds of ultimate despair. But now that they were accepted into the full community, and were recognized for the prudent, loyal people they were free to be ordinary people, husband and wife, and they could argue about how the house should be built. And sometimes Mun Kai, his patience strained by his stubborn Hakka wife, would stomp off in anger, hobbling on his toeless feet to the beach, where he would sit with dying Hawaiian men and confess to them, "No man can understand a woman." And the suffering men would recount their defeats at the hands of women. Then, when the day was done, he would hobble back to his home and wait for Nuktsin, and when he heard her coming, his heart was glad. At one such conciliation, he confessed, "If you were not my kokua, I should be dead by now." And with no pride of either Punti or Hakka, he looked at her in the tropical dusk and said, "Dr. Whipple was right. Wherever a man goes, he finds a challenge. Today the committee asked me to handle the distribution of food because they know I am an honest man. In fact," he admitted proudly, "I am also on the committee itself." They suffered one major worry. What had happened to their baby? In questioning the sailors from the Kilauea, they discovered nothing. Someone vaguely remembered that the child had been handed to a man on the dock at Honolulu, a Chinese perhaps, but he was not sure. With Dr. Whipple dead, there was no way for Nyok Tsin to send an orderly inquiry, so the two Chinese spent some months of quiet anxiety, which was heightened when an incoming leper said, "I know Kimo and Apakela. They gather Miley, but they have only 4 Pake children." The parents fretted, but Nyok Tsin often repeated, "Wherever the boy is, he's better off than here." Mun Kai found escape from his worry through a fortunate discovery. One day, while keeping guard at the beach, hoping for another timber, he happened to notice that some of the small black volcanic pebbles that lined the shore resembled the beans used in the game of Fantan, and he started to gather them, and when he had well over 100 of matched size, he spent a long time searching for a completely flat rock, and although he did not find one, he did stumble across a slab which could be made reasonably smooth by polishing with another stone held flat against the surface. When it was ready, he spread upon it the bean-like pebbles and began picking them up in his damaged hands, slamming them back down on the flat rock and counting them out in 4s. In time, he became so skilled in estimating his initial grab that he could guess with fair accuracy whether the residue would be 1, 2, 3, or 4. And after he had done this for some days, he called to some Hawaiians and showed them the game. For the first 2 days, he merely tested his wits against theirs, and it was one of the Hawaiians who suggested, "We could play a game with those pebbles." And Mun Kai replied casually, "Do you think so?" Since no one had any money, they looked along the beach to find something they could use as counters, and they came upon some hard yellow seeds dropped by a bush that grew inland, and it was obvious that these would make good substitutes for coins. And in this way, the historic Fantan game of the lepers at Kalawao began. When Mun Kai was banker, it was uncanny how, using his 2 stumps of hands, he could grab a number of pebbles, apparently at random, and estimate whether the total was even or odd. And when bets were placed, he was able to hide one of the pebbles, catching it between the base of his thumb and the heel of his damaged hand. If most of his adversaries had their yellow buttons on even, he would drop the hidden pebble, make the residue come out odd, and pocket the profits. But if the bets were concentrated on the odd, he would retain the palmed counter and win again. The game continued for weeks, and more than a dozen men became so excited about it that as soon as the sun was up, they hurried to the beach where the sharp-eyed Pake gambler was willing to stand off their challenges. They played for nothing, only yellow seeds, but they developed agonies of hope over large bets. And in time, one of their number, the big, excitable man named Palani, the biblical Paul, began to accumulate most of the buttons. When Mun Kai saw this, he was pleased. And on the day when Palani finally cornered the seed wealth of the lepers, his Chinese adversary reported to Nyok Tsin, "Palani is getting caught, just as we planned. Pray for me." In the following days, Palani began to lose. If he bet on evens, Mun Kai would drop the hidden pebble in his palm and throw down an odd number. And whenever the Hawaiian decided to risk a lot of seeds and go for a big win on a specific number, say 3, it was a simple matter for Mun Kai to make the pebbles come out even, so that they couldn't possibly yield a 3. The residue might be 2 or 4, but never 3. Slowly, Palani's pile diminished. But Mun Kai knew from the past that the cultivation of a sucker demanded patience and skill. So on some days, Palani triumphed. But over the long haul, he lost. And the afternoon came when Mun Kai ruthlessly drove him down to a mere handful of seeds. Excitement among the lepers was great as the Fantan game progressed, and many were standing about when the Chinese finally broke his adversary completely, whereupon the Hawaiian spectator started joshing the loser, which was what Mun Kai wanted. When the joking was at its height, the Chinese said casually. Polani, why don't we play this way? You have the ridgepole for your house, and I have one for mine. It's ridiculous for neither of us to have a complete roof, so I'll play for your ridgepole against mine. There was an excited hush about the flat rock, and Munkai prayed that the Hawaiian would rise to the challenge. But when the big man did so, he added a stipulation which left the Chinese stunned. To begin with, Polani said simply, "All right, I'll play for the timber. Tomorrow." And Munkai tried to mask his joy, but then the big man added, "And tomorrow we won't pick up pebbles by hand. We'll scoop them up in a cup. And you won't count them, Munkai. Keoki over there will count them." "Don't you trust me?" Munkai pleaded. The big Hawaiian stared at the little gambler and said, "We'll scoop them up in a cup." And he marched off with his friends. Munkai sat alone for a long time, glumly staring at the pebbles on the Fantan Rock. Carefully, he recapitulated each incident in his relationship with Polani. "It all goes back to that day when I saw the big timber first, but he had good feet, so he dashed out and got it for himself. I must have shown my temper. So all along he's known what I've been planning, letting him win and then making him lose. That evil man. All the time I was teasing him, he was really playing with me, letting me make him win and then letting me make him lose. So that while I thought I was trapping him into gambling for his roof, he was trapping me into gambling for mine. These damned Hawaiians." Distraught, he hobbled home, looked up at his precious ridgepole, and threw himself upon his wife's mercy. "Tomorrow we may lose our roof," he said solemnly. "We have no roof, yet," Nyok-tsin replied. "We have the ridgepole," Munkai replied glumly, "and we're going to lose it." "Our ridgepole?" his wife shouted.
"Nyok-tsin, be quiet," he pleaded.
"What have you been doing?" she shouted again, pushing him against the wall. "Did you gamble away our timber?"
"We still have a chance," he assured her.
And then he explained how, while he was leading big dumb Polani into a trap, the wily Hawaiian had really been leading him into one.
"Oh, husband," Nyok-tsin cried, and she began to weep.
But he comforted her, and all night the two Chinese tried to figure out what their chances were now that Polani had insisted that they play the game honestly. As dawn broke, the sleepless Munkai was figuring with a stick in the wet sand, and suddenly he looked up toward his wife with a beatific smile upon his thick, leprous lips. "Our good luck is beginning today," he assured her, and his sweating over the ridgepole ceased. 3 years ago, we started the taro patch, and that was the beginning of our bad luck. We lost our money, got sick, were tricked by the Chinese doctor, and had to leave home. But the 3 years are over. Now our good luck cycle is beginning, Nyok-tsin," he cried triumphantly. "We have 6 years of good luck ahead of us. Today I'll win Polani's ridgepole, and tonight we'll sleep under our own roof." In an ecstasy of hope, he led Nyok-tsin down to the Fantan Rock, where Polani and his Hawaiians were waiting. The pebbles were on the flat surface, and beside them stood a metal cup with a handle. After some discussion, it was agreed that the game should be played in this way. Polani would scoop a cupful of pebbles, and the umpire, Keoki, closely watched by Nyok-tsin, would count them out in fours until the residue was known. Munkai, in the meantime, would bet on odd or even, and would also stipulate a specific number. Thus, if he nominated even and four, and if the pebbles left a residue of four, he would win 2 points for his even guess and 4 points for having guessed the exact number. On the other hand, if he wished to hedge his bets, he could nominate even and three, which would still yield him 4 points if three came up. Then he would scoop up the pebbles, and Polani would name his bets.
and the first man to win 100 points would win the other's roof. Palani, content that he now had the Chinese in an honest game, was satisfied that he would win. But Mun Kai, joyous in the start of his 6-year cycle of good luck, was positive that he would triumph. He watched the big Hawaiian scoop the pebbles, hold them aloft, and wait for his guess. "Odd and three," Mun Kai cried, and the pebbles were deposited before the umpire. Eagerly, the circle of faces closed in for the count. It was a ghoulish crowd that watched the battle for the ridgepoles. Some men had no hands, and some lacked feet. The lips of some had fallen away, and there were many noses missing. From the group arose the unmistakable stench of the leper, and brown skins were often marked with huge, sickly white areas. Hair had fallen out, and sometimes eyes. These were the caricatures of men, those cursed by a malevolent nature so remorseless that few in the world who were not lepers could imagine. These fantan players were indeed the walking corpses, the crawling souls so foul that sound men, seeing them, could only shudder. They were the dead, the bodies thrown onto the beach at Kalawao, the forgotten, the abominated. But now, in the bright sunlight, they laughed merrily, and if the judge had inadequate fingers with which to count in fours, he was allowed to keep his job because he was known as a trustworthy man. "Odd and one," he cried. "2 points to the pake," the crowd cheered. When it came time for Mun Kai to scoop the pebbles, a difficulty presented itself. Although he had been able to play the game with his stumps, he did not have enough fingers to grasp the handle of the cup. So after 2 trial attempts, he appealed to the crowd, and his request was granted. He passed the cup to Nyok Tsin, and she scooped the pebbles. "Odd and three," Palani cried. When the judge had counted, he announced, "Even." "It's our lucky year," Mun Kai shouted joyfully. And then he stopped to explain how a Chinese has 3 bad years, followed by 6 good ones. "The good ones started last night," he chuckled. And on Palani's next scoop, he scored 6 points, for he bet on even and 2, and that's how the pebbles fell. At the midway mark, Mun Kai was leading by a score of 50-39, and it was indeed uncanny how he picked up points. "It's our lucky year," he exulted. And as the sun grew hot, it became apparent that Palani was bound to lose his roof. Nevertheless, he played his numbers stolidly to the end, and when the Chinese gambler had fairly won 100-83, the big Hawaiian jumped up, stretched, and said, "I myself will carry the timber to your house." And the Hawaiians formed a procession, those who could walk, and when they got Palani's driftwood to the stone walls which Nuk Tsin had built, they cut it into lengths for crossbeams, and men who were agile leaped onto the top of the walls, lashed the beams in place, and began tying down the peely grass that others passed to them. By mid-afternoon, the roof was done, and Mun Kai, appraising it proudly, explained to all, "This is really my lucky year." But Nyok Tsin saw the disappointment in Big Palani's misshapen face, and without consulting her husband, she went to the man and said, "In our new house, there is room for another." And she took Palani by the hand and led him inside. The crowd cheered her generosity, and then watched Mun Kai to see what he would do. But he cried, "This is the beginning of my 6 lucky years."
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.